tonight on Arena. We have live music from Kiru, and Twig, Bike Riders and Green Border are our films for review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena or watch us live on rte.ie/arena. It's Thursday film review time, and Arlene Hunt and Chris Wasser have been to the cinema for us. And the films are Bike Riders, Twig and Green Border. Director Marion Quinn makes a comeback with her contemporary crime drama starring Sadie Malone in a modern day adaptation of Sophocles' Antigone, set in the ganglands of Dublin. From the director of the 1990 Academy Award-winning Europa Europa, Polish director Agnieszka Holland's Green Border dramatises accounts taken from refugees on the Belarusian-Polish border. Vroom Vroom, first up, is Jeff Nichols' biker thriller. Aptly named Bike Riders, it boasts big-hitting stars Austin Butler, Jodie Comer and Tom Hardy. This is a potent ode to the violent lives of the 60s biker gangs, depicted with Comer, Butler and Hardy taking the lead in this struggle-come-love triangle inspired by Danny Leon's 1968 photographic study of the Chicago bikers. It's important to know that it is based on this photographic study, or is it important to know that?
I think it is, because it adds a certain amount of authenticity to both the feel of it and the look and the style of the bikes that they use. You have to remember, these guys started off in a motorcycling racing club. These aren't the kind of guys that go out and buy expensive bikes. In fact, they kind of look down on buying expensive bikes. You know, they like to make their own bikes and chop and change and ride kind of hogs and, you know, souped up bikes that they've basically made themselves. And it's very important to them that they you know, that they're able to maintain and look after their own bikes themselves personally.
So in the 60s, Danny Leon would have taken photographs of the culture of these bikers.
Yeah, it's actually interesting that he was allowed to be so close to them, because, you know, they really allowed him in and see the inner workings of what was essentially a private bikers club at the time, you know, before it became very, very massive, you know. And because he's a kid, he's a college kid when we meet him, you know. It's 1960, I think it's 1965, was it?
Mid-60s, yeah.
And he's a college kid, so, you know, but they just allow him to kind of follow them around and ask them questions and take pictures of them all and all the strange characters that sort of accumulate around this bikers club.
So Chris, how do we meet the characters in this? Is it through the Danny Leon character?
Yeah, it's true. Danny interviewing Kathy, played by Jodie Comer, who essentially fills us in. She's the Lorraine Bracco of this piece, and there'll be more Goodfellas comparisons, but she is telling us all about her life with Benny and with Johnny. Benny played by Austin Butler, Johnny played by Tom Hardy. And we're talking about the Vandals. In real life, the
Vandals is the name of the gang.
In real life, they're actually the Outlaws Motorcycle Club. So there's a factual blueprint there for Jeff Nichols, but he actually creates a fictional story out of that. So this is the Vandals Motorcycle Club. It was founded by this guy, Johnny, who watched The Wild One at home one day with Marlon Brando, and he thought, I want to do that. And he was already a biker, but he thought, I want to have my own gang. And it was founded initially as a space for all these like-minded outcasts and oddballs who love motorcycles to just come together, share that love, drink some beers, ride together, maybe share stories about their best and worst days. That was the extent of it. And in doing that, he attracted this guy, Benny. And we don't really know much about Benny other than he is the coolest guy in whatever room he's in. And he's in a bar one night when Kathy walks in looking for a friend, and she essentially leaves with a future husband.
Okay, so we have a clip of this. This is Kathy, played by Jodie Comer. She's in a bar talking to her friend. She sees the Austin Butler character. The friend says, don't go there. But of course, things turn out differently.
Boy, who's that good looking guy over at the pool table?
Oh, Kathy, you don't want to go out with him.
Why not? He don't look like the rest of these animals.
Because nobody wants to go out with him.
Why?
Because he cracks up on his bike. Every time he gets up on his bike, he has an accident.
Oh. Okay.
Let me get you a pop.
I'm Benny.
Hello?
There is no way of mistaking Austin Butler.
Yeah, Austin Butler sounds like Austin Butler and stroke Elvis. Yeah.
So we have the drama then is created presumably by the director, the writer-director, the story, this love triangle, this this violent, you know, fighting between the various biker gangs.
Yeah, there's a couple of dust-ups that are particularly nasty in this. Like at one point, Benny nearly loses his ankle over, you know, because he wouldn't take his colours off, you know, the jackets that they wear that have the name on the back of them. It was very important to him that he kept his colours on at all times. It's a bit of a strange one because the film is kind of told through the eyes of Kathy. And Kathy doesn't really have a whole lot to do apart from follow around after the bikers. Like she doesn't have, I don't know what she did for a living. I don't know anything about the way her thought processes were. She just kind of came across Benny, who's a smouldering, cigarette-chewing love god on screen. And that was it. She just got smitten with him. And then through some gentle stalking on his behalf, he got smitten with her and they just sort of became a couple. But there's nothing... I did find that was the one thing about the movie. There's nothing about her. You don't get any feeling for her other than she's a kind of a wisecracking Karen type, you know, from like a bit like the Goodfellas. Or, you know, she's that kind of nice. She's very naive at the start. Mm. But then she completely just ignores like a ton of red flags in the fumes. And, you know, there's a lot of questions over how he depicts her.
And then the other character is the character played by Tom Hardy.
Yes, so, Johnny.
So what is Johnny's role in the drama? He's the guy who set up the club. What's his relationship with the Benny character?
Well, he's got a family at home, but he almost looks at Benny as, you know, he wants to be Benny, but maybe he also wants to be his father. And he's lining things up so that Benny might take over the club one day. And as I said, he started off the club so that all of these guys, you know, could basically do something on the weekends, you know, that would take them out of their lives, which, again, we don't really know all that much about. But it evolves into, you know, criminality when something happens to Benny. And we see actually how much Johnny loves Benny, that when I already mentioned that incident, when he's attacked by rival bikers, you know, Johnny doesn't just get his revenge. You know, he burns down the bar where Benny was attacked. Like, this is how much he means to him.
That was the scene then when he actually realised how much power he had, because the police come on scene and the fire brigades come on scene and nobody moves to put the fire out and nobody crosses him. And it's the first time with the gang that you see there's more power here than they had originally thought.
Yeah. There's a sinister side to him. And I think also with, like, and you're absolutely right, we don't know that much about Kathy, but we don't really know much about any of the guys. And I think it's the same way that we're working with Danny Leon's photo book. When you open that photo book and you see these extraordinary images, and there is a little bit of text, but you're kind of left to fill in the blanks yourself. And I think Jeff Nichols is kind of doing that with the film. There's a reason he also called this film The Bike Riders. So there were parts where I was wondering, what does Benny do for a living? How have these guys got roofs over their heads? But at the same time, I thought, actually, maybe it's okay that I don't know that. Maybe I can just kind of make that up myself. So I thought, and we also made the plot sound very linear and very straightforward. It's not really. It's kind of a bunch of sequences and vignettes kind of not thrown together, but pieced together very carefully because Jeff Nichols is a very good storyteller. It's a complex film and a flawed one and sometimes a difficult one, but I thought it was mesmerising. I thought
it's nice to look at,
isn't
it?
It's lovely to look at. It's beautiful to listen to.
Are these the action sequences or just looking at
people on
bikes?
Even when they're riding across the country and on the bikes and there's a bike formation and the sound is incredible. So when you've got like 60, 70 bikes coming into a small town, there's this roar of masculine energy underneath it. It's great.
Yeah. I knew nothing about bikes actually going into this film, but I came out wanting to build my own bike. And I don't know whether that's, you know, the intention of the film. I don't want to join a biker gang like what The Vandals actually evolves into, but it is quite seductive. And I think all the performances are brilliant. Even Tom Hardy doing his funny Tom Hardy voice again. He gets a get out of jail free card because he's supposed to be a Brando fan. He is quite compelling in this. There's a lovely chemistry. There's actually a lovely chemistry between Kathy and Benny, despite the fact we don't see much of their romance. It's an awful lot of
Looks.
Yeah, it's an awful lot of shared looks. Yeah.
Okay, stars out of five from you, Chris, for Bike Riders.
I thought it was quite devastating at times too. There's an awful lot of heartache behind that engine noise. It's brilliant. Four stars.
Four stars. Maybe less enthusiastic.
A little bit. I would like more of the characters. I gave it a solid 3 out of 5. I enjoyed watching it, but I just felt there was a lot missing from what we could understand about the characters.
So our second film for this evening is Twig, directed by Marion Quinn, who previously directed the much-loved 32A. This is set against the backdrop of a feud dividing Dublin City. It's a crime drama with a tragic twist. It centres on a young Dubliner, Twig, played by Shadé Malone, who we spoke to on Monday, and she dreams of escaping the city torn by gangland crime. Her two brothers, Eddie and Paulie, are in with the wrong crowd. When tragedy strikes, Tweek sets out to right things by standing up to King Leon. So, Chris, how would you set this up for? It's a modern crime drama, but it's very strongly a blueprint from Antigone by Sophocles.
Oh, absolutely. It's Greek tragedy meets dystopian gangland Dublin. And Malone is, she is Twig. She's this young Dubliner whose family have actually experienced an awful lot of heartache. The parents aren't around anymore. And at the beginning, we see that she's in this very complicated relationship. And we'll learn after a few minutes why it's complicated. Her brothers have gotten involved with the wrong people. They're in deep with the wrong people. And they're involved in this shootout, which ends badly for one brother and forces the other one on the run. So Leon, who is this crime lord played by Brian F. Byrne, he comes in and he says that, you know, clearly one of the brothers is at fault here. So we're mourning the loss of one of them, but we're also saying that other brother is out there. You're to let him rot. He's clearly wounded. No one is, if he dies, no one is to bury him, and that's the way it's going to be. Well, Twig is actually his goddaughter, and she says, no, that guy's my brother, and that's not the way it's going to be. So you have this one person in this Dublin that's clearly run by the crooked and the corrupt standing up to the most terrifying presence in this city. And the twist, you know, I mentioned the romance at the beginning, the twist is that she is actually involved with Leon's son. So you can imagine things get a little bit complicated for her.
So let's go back to the beginning of the film and hear a clip, Sadie Malone as Twig, in this candid moment here with her love interest, who's played by Donica Tynan. He's Eamon, and in this clip we hear her hopes that she could get away from Dublin to another life.
I wish we could take a slow boat to China and no one could catch us.
Let's do it.
You have so much going for you. I'd never take you away from Mother.
I don't want any of it, Twig. I'm not my father.
I know, Eamon. I don't want any part of my family's business either.
We have our passports. I have some cash.
Where would we go?
It doesn't matter. We'd be gone, Twig. We'd be free.
Free?
But there is no hope of that, is there, Arlene? Because she gets caught in this fight to honour her brother.
It's awful because you think, well, why didn't you listen? Why didn't you just get your passports and go? You know, yeah. Because there's a sort of a Romeo and Juliet element to this as well. You know, the star-crossed lovers.
That's right. And of course, his mother and father is Leon, the crime boss.
So Capulet's.
Yes. So she's caught at every...
She's caught in every angle because with the death of her one brother and the other one is fatally wounded as well. And her sister, Izzy, is there. And Izzy is initially very, very, very reluctant to get involved because, you know, they've lost her parents as well. And they only have each other now. And they're very, Izzy's frightened for her. She doesn't want to lose her only sister, you know, and they know how dangerous Leon is. And they know how unhinged he is. Because his rise to the top has been kind of questioned as well. You know, he's not a secure king. He has to show how violent he is. And he can't have any dissent. So that fact that this slip of a girl is standing up to him, and you know, it's for him, that's an impossible task for him as well, because he can't be seen to lose face like that.
Yeah, I thought it was quite a good fit putting this the Sophocles' Antigone into the gangland paradigm. What did you? I don't think you were so happy with the fit, Chris.
I think. As an inspiration, it could have worked, but it wants to honour that ancient text and also at times maybe like twist it and use it a little bit. It wants to do that, and it also wants to be something like kin or love-hate. And I think that awkward juxtaposition, that's what took me out of it. So like the characters would speak one way 1 minute and then a very modern way the next minute. And that just, at times I thought this is a stage play pretending to be a film, and it could work really well as a stage play, but not an awful lot of effort has gone into actually embracing the medium in which it exists.
I thought there was some lovely visual motifs, Arlene, where you saw the funeral and the laying in state of Eddie, which is very much gangland kind of funerals.
Yeah, with all you the flowers, see in the news. It's very dramatic.
Yes, and in the funeral parlour, which looked like an American funeral. in their home, the parlour that was made in her home. And then to counterpoint this with what Twig does with her other brother.
Yeah, and it's quite grim. And she's tremendous in that. I mean, I really believe that scene, you know, where she's devastated over her family and devastated over her family. She carried it really, really well. But I get Chris's point, though, as well, because there's a lot of strange language in it, which, you know, if you're looking at it and you look at it, and actually Kin is a very good description of it, or that kind of love hate. It's very modern Dublin. Mm-hmm. Mm. It's very modern. It has a very modern feel. You're dealing in the flats and there's lots of great shots of Dublin and the trams and everything is quite modern and it's a modern setup. And then every now and then you get this kind of archaic bend in the language that is a little bit, it's a little bit jarring on the ears.
So stars out of five from you, Chris, for Twig.
I thought Malone actually was terrific in it. Like, whatever about the presentation around her being unsteady, she is just terrific. And I think she deserves to be used, and I look forward to seeing what she does next. But I just found the film to be overwritten and also quite largely suspenseless. It never really, I wasn't really interested in what was happening next. So that's a problem. So I think 2.5 stars.
2.5. And from you, Arlene?
I give it a 3 out of 5.
3 out of 5 and 2.5 for Twig. Our final film is Green Border from Polish director Agnieszka Holland, whom Sean spoke to last week also. She is known for directing Europa Europa, which won a Golden Globe for the best screenplay in 1992 and her Academy Award nominated In Darkness. Green Border tackles a humanitarian crisis triggered in 2021 when the Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko encouraged migrants to travel from the Middle East and Africa to the Belarusian border to get onto Europe. Arlene, this is a very specific refugee dilemma, one that we may not be that aware of. And it's given that it was back in 2021. And now, of course, we have the refugee crisis.
Yeah, the change by Ukraine. But this is Syria and Afghanistan. And you know, this is families desperately trying to reach other family members who are already in the EU. And this is like we're looking at Bashir and his family. He's got his wife and his two children.
So this is fictional story, but
it's based on real events. So this is a Syrian family. They come over the escape from ISIS, and the only reason with their grandfather as well. So the only reason they are on that flight is because they were assured it would be a safe flight, because Bashir's wife at one point says, you know, she would never have brought her children. And it's a really good point to remember this. She would never have brought her children via that route if she hadn't been assured of the safety element of it. And of course, as soon as they land, then everything just goes hell in a handbasket, because the people who are supposed to pick them up, they bring them to this other area and then they try to get money from them to try to, extort them, to bring them further, to get them to Poland. And then there's this huge complicated issue.
So they're in Belarus, but they can't get out.
So there's an exclusion zone, a heavily guarded exclusion zone between Belarus and Poland, which is the green zone, the green border. And on one side, you've got, you know, the Polish army, who are absolutely want nothing to do with these people. And just they have been taught that these people are nothing, not much more than vermin, really. And if you let them into the country, they're going to be this, that and the other. And then you've got the Belarusians, who don't want them anymore either. So they want to get rid of them. So there's this horrible shunting back and forth across the border of these human beings who are getting tireder, more thirsty, more unwell. You've got heavily pregnant women trying to move. You've got like very small children and babies trying to get across. And they're just being treated like I wouldn't even say they've been treated like cattle, worse than cattle. You know, just shunted back and forth and back and forth, and nobody wants them. And of course, these are human beings, and it's cold, it's wet, it's dark,
and
it's
Chris,
awful.
We also get the point of view of the border guards,
yes.
And we get the point of view of people who are trying to help the refugees.
Yeah, it divides. I think that it's divided into four perspectives, four segments. We actually spend a good hour with Bashir and his family before we move on to Jan, who is supposed to be this good conflict, maybe good. Conflicted Polish guard who is his wife at home is heavily pregnant, and he obviously starts to develop a bit of a guilty conscience about the way that they're treating these people, that they're treating them like animals. I mean, at one stage one person says that she feels as though she's being treated like a football, the way they're going from one razor barbed wire fence on one edge of this like horrible dangerous swampy forest to the other where the Belarusian guards are. So we see him go from, you know, thinking that he's quite powerful to realizing this is terrible the way we're treating people. And then another perspective is actually Julia, who is this widowed psychiatrist in her 50s. She lives alone on the edge of a forest. She kind of works completely from home, lives she's basically just on her own there. And one day she hears cries from the forest, and she goes out and helps, and she realizes that I want to do something. There's an Afghan refugee dying in the woods, and she comes across this group of local activists who've kind of formed this group of very loose rules where they will look after the people. They'll go out, they'll feed them, they'll clothe them, but they say that they can't take them in. There are limits, obviously, to what they can do. But the story opens up for Juliet when she says, why are there limits? And she starts to do the things that they won't. So there are various different stories happening around the family. I will say, though, that for the first hour when we follow Bashir and his family, that is where the film is extraordinary, because it's so naturalistic. It's almost a docudrama. There are times when you begin to actually question, I know this is a fictional work inspired by true stories, but this looks and sounds so real. It's actually terrifying.
And Arlene, even though it's a specific story and a specific area and a specific border, there are universal themes, as you've been exploring there.
Well, even the idea that you cannot help, and I understand the activists' argument, because if they're caught, their whole thing is closed down. They lose any chance they have of paying it forward or helping more people. Mm. But I also understand, you know, why if you find someone who's close to death in the woods, do you leave them behind? Is that humane? Is that the right thing to do? And then we got reports just this week, you know, about in people on boats in Greece being thrown into the water and allowed drown because they're a nuisance. We don't want them. And this is very much the case here, because there's a scene where Jan and the other guards are being sort of buoyed up by a commander who comes to their place. And it's the language he uses. He dehumanizes every single one of these refugees. He dehumanizes them completely. He doesn't even use the word refugees. You know, it's just constantly this, like this vermin arriving. And it's their job to stem the tide, you know. And it's hard to watch, because when you look at pregnant women and small babies and children, and a really wonderful portrayal of the grandfather in this, who's just the sweetest, kindest man, and a really wonderful woman from you know, Afghanistan, whose brother had worked with the Polish people, and you see them as humans and you see them as people. So it's very hard to watch then as they're being shunted around.
So it sounds like a hard watch, but a worthwhile watch.
Oh, it is. It's a difficult watch, but it's an important one. And I think, and also in some ways, I mentioned it there. Sometimes it moves like a horror film. I think at times it veers dangerously close in the third act to sort of didactic melodrama. But I think that's to be forgiven. The performance are brilliant. The director also shot it in this icy monochrome, which leaves a mark. It's 4 stars from me.
4 stars from you, and for you for Green Border, Arlene.
Oh, I gave it a good 4. It's a very quietly devastating film, so just be aware of that if you're going in to watch it.
Okay, before we go, we've heard the sad news of the Canadian actor Donald Sutherland, who died aged 88. He was the star of Ordinary People, MASH, and 6 Degrees of Separation. I was thinking of Casanova, Don't Look Now. I mean, such a wonderful actor.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Unlike any other. I actually saw before we came in tonight that a friend of mine, and also a friend of the show's Donald Clark, was noting the fact that he was never nominated for an Oscar, which is just extraordinary.
Shocking.
Given that he was one of the best character actors. Like, his work in Don't Look Now.
Such a brave actor.
Yeah. His film choices from Don't Look Now, MASH, The Dirty Dozen, and then later on in his career, the Hunger Games
films.
The whole generation relearned
who he was from the Hunger Games.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, very sad day indeed. Thank you very much, Chris Wasser and Arlene Hunt. Cork Midsummer Festival is in full flow in Cork. Last night we heard about the visual arts events, and tonight we're concentrating on dance and the award-winning choreographer and dancer Ben Duke, who is presenting his version of John Milton's epic poem Paradise Lost, renamed Paradise Lost Lies Unopened Beside Me. In 2016, it won the National Dance Critics Award for Outstanding Male Performance. Conceived, directed and performed by Ben Duke, Ben brings to life the often forgotten and misunderstood origin story of heaven and hell, from the rebellion of the angels to the expulsion of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden. To navigate this story of creation, destruction and regret, Duke embodies the characters of God, Satan, Jesus, Adam and Eve. A few days ago, Sean Rock spoke to Ben Duke and began by asking him if he fell in love immediately with Paradise Lost when he studied it at university.
I wouldn't say it was love at first sight. I think it took me a while to kind of get into it, but I did eventually get into it. And there was a kind of, once you get past that initial thing of the kind of density of the language, it is an amazing poem. Obviously, it's an amazing poem. I guess that's why it's why it takes up its place in the canon. But it's like the characters were the thing for me. I hadn't realized it was going to be quite so vivid and quite so theatrical. So that was the kind of big discovery for me. And that drew me into it.
I think your relationship with the piece then developed further when you became a father.
That's right. Yeah, it did. I mean, when I was at university, I kind of had dreams of becoming a, you know, hotshot film director, and I imagined making this kind of epic film version of Paradise Lost. It was already kind of forming in my head who I was going to cast and what the scenes were going to look like. But that didn't kind of pan out, and then my career went off into dance and creating dance theatre. And yeah, there were two things that happened. I suppose there was this interest in making a solo and trying to think about what was the kind of biggest, most ridiculous story I could try and tell as a solo. And then also that was combined with my wanting to make a piece that was talking about the experience of fatherhood. I had two kind of young children at the time I made it, and that felt like it kind of gave me a different way into the poem.
Yeah, I suppose even when often God in the Christian tradition is referred to as God the Father, did that play in? Did you feel in some ways that you had been part of a creative act yourself, or an act of creation?
I did. I did feel like I'd been part of an act of creation, and an act of creation that was so kind of beyond anything I could imagine, that I, you know, without sounding kind of too arrogant about that, I felt like I kind of empathized with God a little bit in that moment, this idea of creating something, setting something off into the world, and then also feeling quite overwhelmed by its independence and by the kind of fear that comes up as soon as you have children. So yeah, there was some kind of parallel with myself and the God of Milton's poem, who is very much a father, and he creates both the angels and Lucifer in heaven, and then he also creates the universe and Adam and Eve and all of these creations. I think in my reading of that poem slightly escape the bounds of his initial plans.
Yeah, I think your God is perhaps a little bit more shambolic, or do you think that Milton Manfred, in fact, presents us with a kind of shambolic God?
I would definitely say my God is more shambolic than Milton's and more incompetent. But I do think that Milton was, you know, he was a very religious man, and his God was, what I loved about the poem was the way that his God was kind of torn between this spiritual being, but also in writing about this spiritual being, Milton couldn't help but talk about the body, and he made them very, God and Lucifer, he makes them very concrete, and so he makes them very human. And as a result, for me, there's something quite fallible then in that character that I maybe took to an extreme by turning God into a slightly overwhelmed, incompetent father.
I wonder what his attitude is then, God, or indeed Lucifer, or whoever it is that's involved in the dancing to this particular piece of music.
Yeah.
Music of Richard Strauss there, of course, and the Sunrise section from also Sprach Zarathustra. It's part of the music that is used by Ben Duke in his dance performance, Paradise Lost Lies Unopened Beside Me, which is part of this year's Cork Midsummer Festival, and Ben speaking to me on the programme this evening. I do wonder, given that you have the shambolic god that you spoke about before that, and it has to be said, I think you have fun with all of the characters, with Lucifer, with Adam and Eve, and with all of the that kind of dynamic is that, that is there within that Christian tale. Given that you use that very epic piece of music, how tongue-in-cheek is the dance performance around that piece of music in particular, Ben?
I suppose it is quite tongue-in-cheek. It's I use that music as a moment of kind of as you say, it's so epic and grand, and it sets up so much kind of expectation. And I use it for this moment when God kind of arrives in the space and his kind of initial act of creation. And I guess it's tongue in cheek, but it's also this thing that is very interesting to me that I find in the poem, but also in this kind of dance theatre piece, which is the kind of power of the imagination. So a piece of music like that generates so much in our imagination. Perhaps what I'm doing on stage can't possibly match that and is a little bit underwhelming. But in a way, there's that kind of juxtaposition of that underwhelmingness of what I'm doing versus the kind of epic scale of what that music generates. So I'm interested in how music can be a kind of trigger for the imagination as well.
The other thing I wondered about is the fact that it is so text-bound. Obviously, it's a poem. It's a poem that is full of words. How much of the text do you use, and how difficult is it when you're not using text to perform the narrative, the very strong narrative of, you know, Lucifer falling down into hell and the expulsion of Adam and Eve from the Garden of Eden? How difficult is it to portray that, just you, yourself, and dance?
I mean, there are quite a lot. I use a lot of words. I mean, I'm paraphrasing heavily from the text and abridging heavily from the text. And I use some lines from the poem, but not that many. And that was part of the thing for me, which was why the kind of subtitle of, you know, Lies Unopened Beside Me, because in a way, during the process, I was quite... I felt the weight of the book next to me and the power of Milton's language and how I couldn't quite live up to that. And each time I tried to read some of the poem, how inadequate I found my version next to it. So there's something about the act of creation, or the act of adaptation, I suppose, in response to Milton's poem. And also, I think I'm relying a bit on the story being kind of familiar. You know, people maybe been aware with the story of Genesis that he's rewriting. And so there's probably some shortcuts I'm taking. Not that you have to be familiar with that story, but that I know those stories exist in the kind of collective consciousness a bit.
And given that you do get to perform all of the characters, God, Satan, Adam and Eve, is there a particular favourite or a particular favourite dynamic between those characters for you?
I really enjoy the relationship between God and Satan. I really enjoyed that in the poem, and I hope I've kind of transferred that onto the stage. And I've made them, more contemporary, perhaps, than they are in the poem. But I find that relationship fascinating because I think Satan is really there saying, what is all this hierarchy that you've set up? I thought there was some kind of equality here in heaven, but actually you've set up something with you and your son as kind of absolute leaders. And Satan, I think, understandably has an issue with that. But also Satan was God's favorite at the beginning. You know, he was a kind of brightest star. So there's something fascinating and very human about that kind of power struggle and jealousy and closeness and all of that I like.
Yeah, well, and it sounds fascinating that you can get a poem into a piece of dance theatre that lasts about 75, 80 minutes, I believe.
Yeah.
You might finish up, if you would, Ben, by telling me, how is Janis Joplin's Summertime used within the piece?
Yes. Well, Janis Joplin's Summertime is, it kind of came in a funny way, but essentially Janis Joplin's Summertime for me was a great song for the moment when Eve bites into the apple and the world kind of changes for her and she suddenly sees things in a different way. And for me, that Janis Joplin version of that song, which is both has that amazing, you know, her voice has such a kind of edge to it, and yet it's also about this kind of blissful idea of summer.
Well, we'll finish up by listening to that Janis Joplin version of Summertime. Thanks very much for being with us this evening, Ben, and good luck with the show.
Thank you, Sean.
And here is Janis. Summertime, child, you're living easy. Fish are, jumping now. Hey, the cotton lord, cotton is high. She's a mighty good-looking lady. I said she's looking pretty fine to me now. Hush, baby, 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 baby. No, 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 don't you cry.
Summertime, performed by Janis Joplin. Before that, you heard Sean talking to Ben Duke, who is presenting his version of Paradise Lost at the Cork Midsummer Festival. More information from corkmidsummer.com. Festival in a Van has been touring music, theatre and poetry events all over Ireland since 2020. This year it has a new string to its bow in North County Dublin. Sounds Like Summer Fingal Festival in a Van is a 6-day tour to celebrate all the best talent in Fingal and around. It opens tomorrow, taking place this weekend and next, and includes artists like Paula Meehan, Trish Riley and Kiru. Kiru, or Kieran Allen, is a Dublin-based musician who grew up in East Africa. He has a new single out tomorrow, Mbingu, which means heaven in Swahili. Delighted that Kiru joins me now in studio with Rio Orderile on percussion, who we'd be both hearing in a moment. You're both very welcome.
Thank you so much.
So you've played the festival in a van before. Tell us a little bit about it. What was the experience like?
So the festival in a van started in the lockdown. So they got in touch with me, it must have been a couple of years ago, and they were doing some gigs over in schools, out in the yards in schools. And they were also doing places like reception centres for refugees. And so I played a few gigs in different places with them. Each one was quite different. And I just thought it was really creative, kind of brought me, still people still needed music. So I thought it was lovely the way they, because everything had to be outside. So it was outside. And it was gorgeous, and the van is really beautiful. It's painted, and it goes around the country taking
and
music.
And you arrive in the van, and does the van open out into a theatre, or is it that just the advertising, and then you perform somewhere else?
So from the side, the van looks normal, but then if you go, it just has Festival Van written, but then at the back opens out to a stage, and the door turns into the front of the stage. So you're kind of halfway in the van, but we've squeezed a few people. You've played on that van, haven't you? Yeah. So we squeezed three or four of us in there as well. Yeah.
Now, Kiru is your stage name.
That's right.
Yes. So where does that come from?
So Kiru is a name I acquired. I'm Irish, but I was raised in East Africa in Tanzania. And I acquired Kiru kind of as a nickname. And then as an adult, I was living in Spain for years. And also as a child, when I was in Tanzania, people could never pronounce Kieran in either of those countries. So when I was living in Spain and I was doing a lot of music, I started using Kiru as the musical name and also my name. And then when I came back to Ireland about 10 years ago, I kept Kiru as the musical name because right. it also reflected kind of the style of music as a mix of those places. So.
Yes, and it is a very musical name as well. There is music in the name. Bring us back to Tanzania and how your parents met or why were your parents there? Because your father is Irish.
My father's Irish, yeah. My mother actually comes from England and then they met in Kenya. They were both living in Kenya, obviously before I was born, and they met. And then as a small child, we went back. I moved back to, they were living in Kenya and I went back to Tanzania with the whole family and was raised there in between Dar es Salaam and Moshi. And then I spent some years in Kenya where they had lived as well at a school there, kind of went to boarding school there. So,
and Mbingu then is a Swahili word.
Mbingu, yeah.
Yes, Mbingu. Mm-hmm. And can you speak Swahili?
I can indeed, yeah.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah, yeah. And Rio, are you Botswanan American. Yeah. Do you, have you... Is Swahili a language you have a knowledge
of?
No,
not at all. I only speak English.
Just through me. He speaks a few words of Swahili with me.
Yeah, because I thought when you were doing your sound check there, I thought, are they speaking, or is Kiru speaking Swahili? I think you were throwing a word that way.
Yeah. I might have been talking about parts of the song.
Oh, yeah, that's probably what it was.
Yeah, and tell us about your drum, Ria.
Yeah, so here I just have a djembe drum. So I was normally going to go for a cajon, but had a situation. And
pounding it too hard.
And so destroyed it. So today we're doing the djembe and just a little shaker.
So Mbingu, what are you singing about here? And will you introduce it for us?
Of course. So Mbingu is my latest single. I'm so delighted to release it tomorrow on all the platforms. Mbingu means heaven. And the message of the song is that heaven is here on earth. We need to make heaven on earth. And it's a song about loving and protecting Mother Nature, sung in different languages. And the recorded version of the song also includes little messages in different languages from around the world. So I actually sent out a text to people and got them to send me a 5-second voice note in their language from everywhere in the world about why they love Mother Nature or what they would like for it. And the song itself came about through a collaboration with Kian Sweeney. He's a fabulous Cork-based producer. He goes by the name Thousand Beasts in his own project, but as a producer, we worked on the song together, Kian and myself. He kind of came up with the basic structure and the basic riff, and then I built the song around it. He showed me the riff, and I loved that it sounded kind of East African. Without unbeknownst to him, he played it for me, and I was like, oh, that sounds a bit like music from Congo, something like Lingala or Kwasa Kwasa or something. It's the stuff that I would hear as a child in Tanzania. So I built the song around that. And then the theme of nature is just something really important to my heart.
And what languages should we listen out for as we listen to the song?
So the one we're going to sing now, it's in English, Swahili, and there's a bit of Spanish as well. I lived in Spain as well for many years in my 20s. And on the recorded version that's coming out on the platforms tonight, actually at midnight, people will also be able to hear voices in a whole load of different languages, including Turkish, Chinese, French, English, Swahili, More from Burkina Faso, and lots of different other languages.
Fantastic. So will you take it away, so?
Of course. Thank you so much. Mingu, hai kuju, hai kukunye ma winku. Mingu, hai kuju. Hai kukunye ma wingu. It's in the air, we pull and breathe, burst through the roots of ancient trees. Soon the ocean swelling wave sweeps out along the rolling plain, creeps through the patient glacial surge, piles on the sloping mountain verge, soaked in the rays of sunrise burn, switched into porpin or lion fern. Tonight, Jenga Duniani,
mani Tunai cenga mili mani Porini, vicicini Nami tuta weza pamoja Nami tuta weza komoja Zingira yako je Tumeyaharibu Tufanye niniwe Tuyarekebishe Tuyarekebishe No tenemos otro lugar Donde ir No No Nos rodea es el cielo, el paraíso. No tenemos otro lugar de ir, no. Lo que ya nos rodea es el cielo, el paraíso. Mingu, haukuchu, hauku kwenyema wingu.
Oh, Imbingu. Very good. That was just wonderful. Thank you so much. It's such a rhythmic song. I suppose African music has such rhythm in it. We did a special night of Afrobeat with Yankari.
Oh, and
it
was the good same. Pals. They're good pals, great.
Yeah, the audience just were up dancing. Oh, it's amazing, just the rhythm. I guess it's the drums, but it's also, you can hear that in your vocal as well, that rhythm.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's wonderful to be here.
Kiru, you are working towards an album.
Yes, so this would be one of the new songs that's gradually working towards an album. I'm hoping to release another single in the next couple of months, a song called Kyanites, which is in English, that's more like a pop rock song. And I hope to have a new album. I hope to start recording a new album in the new year. I have all the material ready to go. I want to work on some arrangements with the band, with the guys I collaborate with, people like Rio and a lot of other people around Dublin. And it's great actually to have Rio here because we were trying to recreate the recorded song, which is very different.
Broken down version.
Yeah, broken down version. But
yeah, it worked out though.
And again, just when we were talking to Yankari that time, they were talking about the message being so strong. And I think with you too, you talked about nature there. You talked about, you know, minding Mother Nature, protecting it. Is that going to be the theme of the album as well?
It'll be one of them. Yeah, there'll be different themes. Nature seems to make it into a lot of songs, at least somewhere. I often mix up themes in songs, so I'll throw in a line about nature here and there. I do have on my album, which is called Super Feo Express, I have another song particularly focused on nature, which is called Sunrise, Sunset, with nature and peace as well.
Yes, that was your 2019
album.
2019 album. Mm-hmm. And then we have guitar here and we have percussion. What will be the sound on the new album?
The new album, the new song, the Mingu itself, is produced. Produced with lots of different instruments. So there's piano, there's guitar, there's kind of background synth, there is drums, percussion, there is different types of guitar as well, and then all the voices. And then on the album, what happens with my music is that, for example, in the Super Feo Express album, each of the songs is kind of a different genre. So depending on the genre, I'll decide what instruments need to go on there.
And you're also working on a project called Bruntness, which
that's right,
Gift.
Yeah. So having moved back to Ireland about 10 years ago, obviously I was immersed in other types of music for a long time, but particularly in the last few years, I've got back into Irish music as well. So I do weekly trad backing gigs and ballads and stuff like that, and I also play the concertina. I've been going to Kiltis as a grown-up learner, as an adult learner, and I love it. And that's I started writing music that sounded more like jigs and reels and stuff like that, and it's mainly piano based. So because it was so different from Kiru, I thought, okay, this is actually a different project, because I started doing a few songs that were kind of like that. So I thought, okay, I'm going to have another persona called Brontanus. Brontanus means gift, and my middle name is Zawadi, which my parents gave me. So Zawadi means gift in Swahili. So I just translated from Swahili to Irish.
Fantastic. Well, Kiru, thank you so much for coming in. And Rio, thank you so much for that performance. And I hope Festival in a Van is a huge success. Kiru plays the 28th of June at 4 p.m. at the Dunsanaha Estate in Balbriggan as part of Sounds Like Summer Fingal Festival in a Van. The festival runs from the 21st to the 30th of June. Further details from festivalinavan.com. Thank you both so much. That's it for tonight. Tonight's show. The programme was researched by Liam Murphy and Paula Shields. Tom Norton was on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator, and tonight's show was produced by Therese Kelly. And John Creedon is next after the news at 8.